Energy. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. Today on Flashpoints, we feature our weekly series with Code Pink and are joined by Colonel Ann Wright, who just returned from a fact-finding visit to Cuba. We're then proud to present another installment of the Electronic Intifada with Neuro Barrows Friedman. I'm Kevin Pina, and we'll be right back with that and more here on Flashpoints. And welcome back to another edition of your daily investigative news magazine, Flashpoints. Well, let's go ahead and open this program with a well-known bite that's circulating of the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, giving a now infamous prayer before the assembled at the Pentagon. Listen in.
Let every round find its mark against the enemies of righteousness and our great nation. Give them wisdom in every decision, endurance for the trial ahead, unbreakable unity, and overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. Preserve their lives, sharpen their resolve, and let justice be executed swiftly and without remorse, that evil may be driven back and wicked souls delivered to the eternal damnation prepared for them. For the wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. We ask these things with bold confidence in the mighty and powerful name of Jesus Christ, King over all kings, and Amen.
And that was the voice of Secretary of War, or, you know, the press these days won't even acknowledge the change of the name. They still continue to call it the Secretary of Defense, the Department of Defense. And now joining me is Cynthia Papermeister. She's with Code Pink. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Well, we just heard Pete Hegseth go on his rant about, you know, Jesus being on the side of the United States and how this is a new holy war. What's your view on that? And what is Code Pink doing in response to this? Oh, I don't know. This isn't even the confluence of church and state anymore. This is something else altogether.
You know, this is one of the scariest moments that I can remember. Our Secretary of War believes that he and Trump has his finger on the nuclear weapons button, are anointed by God to bring about the apocalypse. I'm just going to say that one more time. They feel that they are anointed by God to bring about the apocalypse or the end times. And Hegseth holding prayer meetings at the Department of Defense or War, I mean, it's alarming. 200 military members have filed complaints about Hegseth's violations of religious regulations. So his religious crusade, in which key deciders are motivated by extremist religious agendas, not just imperialism, oil, and AIPAC, is just scaring the bejesus out of us. So no wonder they don't care about killing civilians or the war spreading. So we're just forming a campaign. We're getting it underway to get him out. He's got to be gotten out. Now, there is some good news. 30 members of Congress have sent a letter to the Department of Defense asking for an investigation of what he's doing over there, holding these prayer meetings. And, let's see, one of the lawmakers said, these outrageous statements justifying a war based on interpretations of biblical prophecies and informing troops that they are risking their lives to advance a specific religious vision raises not only glaring constitutional concerns, but potential violations of Department of Defense regulations regarding religious neutrality.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, it's like sounding the alarm with Code Pink and everyone else. He cannot stay at the Department of War, the Department of Defense. He cannot. This is really, really scary.
Well, this goes, I believe, to this question of Armageddon and what many evangelicals call the literal interpretation of the Book of Revelations, right? Gog and Magog and all of this language that basically says that you know, this all leads to the second coming of Christ, and that somehow Trump is now the trigger that God has used to bring about the end of the world. And you're right. It's absolutely insane. And I thank God. There you go. Thank goodness. Thank whatever deity you praise that Code Pink is waging this campaign to get rid of this maniac. I mean, even just the, you know, Department of Defense, the Department of War, maybe it was a little more honest, because honestly, it's always been sort of the Department of War. But I mean, just the fact that he's now put himself in the mantle. I mean, you've probably heard these speeches, right, that he's given about Iran, right? We negotiate through bombs. We negotiate through bombing, right? We don't talk. Our diplomacy is dropping more bombs on the enemy. This is unheard of in U.S. foreign policy.
Not just on the enemy. As Trump has said, he wants to bring them back to the Stone Age. That is a war crime.
Absolutely.
So Hegseth, Trump, these are war crimes that they
are advocating.
Bridges,
schools, exactly, hospitals. They are war crimes. And I think that maybe at least given the level of technology and recording that we have going on around the world, that at least now a good portion of it's in the public record, right? It's not going to go away. And it, I think what Code Pink does is really important, because what you guys do is you guys actually act in many ways as the institutional memory of these sorts of horrendous crimes that are done by the U.S. government, and particularly what's going on under the Trump administration today.
Yeah, yeah, we're trying. We just keep trying. We've been at it for over 20 years, and we have to keep going. A friend was just here. She's been crying a lot because she's been to Iran. You know, it's a beautiful country full of beautiful people. They don't deserve what we're doing to them, and we don't deserve to be paying for that. You know, there's... we're having a hard time paying taxes for this kind of thing. It's $1 billion a day that we are spending on this illegal war of choice.
And again, that's the voice of Cynthia Papermeister. She is with Code Pink. Well, Cynthia, let's talk a little bit more. You know, I always don't want to assume that somebody hasn't just tuned in who doesn't know who Code Pink is or anyone that I'm interviewing. Let's talk a little bit about who Code Pink is, what Code Pink is, and the work that you guys are doing.
Okay, thank you. Well, we are a feminist grassroots organization of not just women. We originally called ourselves Code Pink Women for Peace. We have every gender identity involved. And we are an activist group. We confront, expose, disrupt the war machine, wherever we see it. We're famous for our sort of gutsy confrontations, especially in Congress. You'll see one of our co-founders, Medea Benjamin, and colleagues in Congress a lot, disrupting hearings and trying to interview senators and representatives as they're scurrying around the Capitol with hard-hitting questions. Why are you supporting this genocide? Why are you voting my tax dollars for 2,000-pound bombs for Israel? Those kinds of questions. And they don't like it. Most of them, they don't like to be confronted. And that's fine. This is this is our job as Code Pink, just to expose their hypocrisy, their cruelty, their lack of compassion for other people. And these are the sort of monsters who are running our government. So just to be honest with you, we have to keep going. We have to keep going and doing this work. And we do it with joy. We do it with love. Code Pink wears pink. You see us out there, and we're easily identified because, you know, we like to wear pink. One of our co-founders, Jody Evans, likes to say five women wearing pink is very, very noticeable. But we are not a threat to anybody. We're a totally nonviolent organization. Now, I do want to say one thing, though, that is really bothering me. The right-wing media and some of the politicians are saying that Code Pink is somehow agents of the Russians and the Chinese. They don't like dissidents, and they never have. They, meaning the war machine and the government. We are dissidents, and we're proud of it. We are patriots. We want this country to follow the law, follow the Constitution, follow the law. which is being broken all the time.
International law.
Yeah. And not just by Trump, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, and members of Congress who are funding weapons for Israel. That is illegal. That is illegal under many U.S. and international laws. So to get our government to follow the law and to put human needs before the war machine's greed, that's our work.
Sounds good to me.
We're working at it all the time. We don't stop.
And again, that's the voice of Cynthia Papermeister. We are talking about Code Pink. And I've also heard, you know, you're paid protesters, right? You guys are paid, you know, and I know a lot of folks in Code Pink, and they're not exactly well-to-do or well-heeled, you know. Folks are contributing their time.
They don't get any payment from anybody. It went from
you're a communist to now you're a paid protester. These people are shameless.
They are. They like to smear. They really like to smear activists. And they're working hard at it. But, you know, we're not going to stop.
You said you've been arrested many times yourself for civil disobedience. Let's talk a little bit about what's that like? What does that look like? Has that taken a personal cost on you to do that, to commit yourself to that?
Not at all. The arrests that I've experienced have been just a minor inconvenience. Usually I pay out, I've given a citation, I pay out. This happens in Washington, D.C. when I've been arrested there. But I have been recently arrested for felony vandalism for putting my washable red paint handprints on Nancy Pelosi's garage door. That's the worst arrest I've had. And that is an ongoing situation where the San Francisco District Attorney's Office is prosecuting me for felony vandalism.
Why Nancy Pelosi?
Well, she, at the time we did this in February 2024, we were asking her to call for a ceasefire and an arms embargo on Israel. And I organized an event at her house in San Francisco, and a lot of people came up to her house. Part of the event or the action was writing messages to her on Valentine's. It was around Valentine's Day. And part of it was pouring red paint in the street and on the sidewalk to symbolize the bloodshed that she was funding with her votes in Congress, or her lack of bringing a ceasefire resolution to the floor of Congress. So we were out of our minds with grief and anguish over that for San Francisco. Mm. She wasn't representing San Francisco. San Franciscans and Democrats generally, her base, wanted a ceasefire really badly. And she was not only ignoring us, she was saying to us, go back to China.
Wow.
Where your headquarters is.
So you were targeting her to hold her accountable.
Yes, we wanted her to do something about the genocide.
Right.
Yeah. 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 We were grieving. I was on a 20-day hunger strike when I got kind of carried away, and I put my hands in the red paint we were using, which is washable tempera paint. We made sure to use something that was legal. And I just got really carried away. I put my handprints on her garage door. So I admit to doing that, but that's not a felony.
So when they charge you with vandalism for that?
Yeah. Two counts of felony vandalism.
Felony vandalism, because it was her garage and not just a public.
Because she's saying that the damage cost her over $900 or something. Yeah. I mean, this was washable paint. I'm laughing, but that was in February 2024, and I am still having to go to court every month, and they just continue it month after month. Hopefully we are having a pretrial hearing coming up, and we want them to present evidence that I committed a felony.
I want all you young Gen Zers who are out there to listen. You are talking to a treasure here in the San Francisco Bay Area, someone who has risked and put her personal safety in order to make a statement to oppose war in this country, to oppose the war machine. And before we go, Cynthia, I know that Code Pink is also holding a national action on tax day. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. This is really, really important for people who are listening. On April 15, there's a National Tax Day of Action. You can check taxpayersagainstgenocide.org or codepink.org to see where there's an action near you. We are sick and tired of paying our taxes to fund illegal wars, occupation, genocide, and ICE. Over 50% of federal discretionary spending goes to the war machine, including to Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Palantir, etc. They're making billions for their shareholders from our continual wars. So come out on April 15 in San Francisco. The location will be the Israeli consulate, starting at 4:30. That's at 456 Montgomery Street. In Sonoma County, where I live, the action is called Stop Funding ICE, Empire, and Genocide at 4 p.m. at the IRS on Sonoma Avenue. Go to those websites, taxpayeragainstgenocide.org or codepink.org, to get the details. And please come out on the 15th. We're sick of this. Taxes going for this horrible, horrific violence. Thank you so much.
Cynthia, I can't thank you enough for letting me host you today. Of course, all my love to all of your ilk and all of you folks. Stay strong, stay independent, and know that there are folks out here who know the work you're doing and support you.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
And now it's a pleasure to have Colonel Ann Wright join us. She spent 29 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves and 16 years as a high-level U.S. diplomat before famously resigning in March 2003 in direct protest of the illegal invasion of Iraq. Since putting down her uniform, she's been a relentless peace advocate and a frontline organizer with Code Pink. She just returned from a solidarity and fact-finding delegation to Cuba, breaking through the blockade to stand with the Cuban people. Ann Wright, welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. And you just returned from Havana with Code Pink. The State Department always claims that sanctions are targeted at the government, not the people. Having just walked the streets and spoken directly with everyday Cubans, what is the actual material impact of this engineered energy crisis and the blockade on the working class families trying to survive there?
Well, the effects are terrible. I mean, in the most recent addition to the embargo was the oil embargo. Trump in January put a prohibition against any country bringing oil into the country. And so for 8 weeks, there was no oil, and you could tell it immediately. I mean, I was in Cuba in January and then went back in March. And it was like a ghost town on the streets because there were very, very few cars that were on it. Even the number of motor scooters and things like that were substantially, there were not many of them that were there because there's just not fuel to run the cars. And if they can find some, it's extraordinarily expensive. So the sanctions have been biting the people of Cuba for 65 years. But this latest thing of the embargo on the oil really, really put a heavy hand on them. So when finally, after we left, and hopefully it was because there was a lot of international attention that came to Cuba because of this large international group called Nuestra America Convoy, about 700 activists from, I think it was 35 countries, came to Cuba on one weekend to bring media to see what was going on and write articles very, very quickly after we went back home about what we saw. And then we saw that President Trump switched around. He did a flip-flop and allowed a Russian fuel tanker to come into Havana. So that is a very good sign, but we've got to keep the pressure up so that more fuel tankers can keep bringing oil in because it's just a short supply. And that horrible decision of the Trump administration to put the oil embargo on to start with, we've got to really push back so it is taken off the books.
Again, that's the voice of my guest, Colonel Ann Wright. She recently returned from a delegation fact-finding mission with Code Pink. Well, Ann, the foundation of the current economic warfare against Cuba is its inclusion on the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list. It's a Trump era designation that essentially cuts the entire country out of the global banking system. As someone who's worked at the highest levels of the U.S. military and the State Department, how absurd is it that Cuba's on this list? And how does a specific financial weapon prevent the island from importing basic medications, fuel and food?
Well, it's this designation of state sponsor of terrorism, of course, is a lie. Cuba does not sponsor state terrorism anywhere. What it does sponsor are medical staff, doctors that go all over the world to help in countries where the medical system needs some assistance. So if you call that terrorism, I guess they're guilty. But as far as violence and overthrow of other people's governments, could that be the United States overthrowing, right. Kidnapping and head of state in Venezuela. So Cuba is not doing that. And it is a lie that the Trump administration put on in its first administration. And then it wasn't taken off until the latter days of the Biden administration. Joe Biden ought to be ashamed that he did absolutely nothing for Cuba during the 4 years he was in there, when 8 years as vice president with Obama, that's when the big opening came for Cuba. And you could see remarkably how important the world banking system is to all countries, and Cuba in particular. You could see how more airplanes, flights from the United States, which still do occur. I mean, American, Delta, and Southwest go into Cuba, although most Americans don't think there are any U.S. carriers, but they do. But before, under the Obama administration, these flights were going in not only to Havana, but to various cities in Cuba, and allowing Cuban Americans who are in the United States a wonderful opportunity and a cheaper opportunity to go to Cuba to visit their families and to bring goods that they wanted to give to their families. And it's always been a place only 90 miles from the United States. I mean, it's just so close, and yet it's so far in people's minds that it's almost like a continent away. But it's very close by, and we want to encourage U.S. citizens to organize or go singly. But if you take a family, take a group of 10 people, there are hotels that you can stay in, although the Trump administration has virtually put every hotel in Cuba, with the exception of five, and they're all five-star hotels. That we don't want to stay in five-star hotels, but that's the only ones that legally you can stay in, because of they're putting all the rest of them, saying they're government operated, so you can go and stay in hotels, and you can make your own decision on what you want to do, where you want to stay. And of course, there are lots of private homes that are opened up to international guests. And there are also, private restaurants that are there. So Cuba is a place that for everyone that goes for the first time, it's kind of a real eye opener of, holy smoke, this is, other than the sanctions and there not being enough paint, enough this, so that. But I mean, it's a human country. There are humans that live there who are trying to live good, productive lives. And if the U.S. would just get off their backs, they could really, really have a wonderful life there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who you visited. What did you see? Were you able to just travel freely in the streets, go to the places you wanted to, and talk to people? Let's talk a little bit about that personal experience for you.
Yes. Well, this time, because of the fuel shortage, we decided that we were not going to take advantage of what little fuel is left by ourselves, hiring buses and things like that. We told everybody from the beginning, all 170 people that were on the Code Pink delegation, to wear your walking shoes, because we're walking every place we go. Great. Although there were a few folks that every now and then would hire a pedicab or something like that. But in general, we wanted to walk the streets, and we did. And we met all sorts of wonderful Cubans who were walking in their neighborhoods and walking kids to school or walking their animals on the streets or just hanging out. And by walking, you met lots of people. We had a photographer, a well-known photographer from Washington, D.C., Bill, who he said that was the best experience of his life, that he walked everywhere. He talked with so many people, took pictures of families and just the ordinary life of Cuba. So it was a really excellent experience. And I think all of us, when we go back again, even though we can hire taxis and there probably will be more gas and things like that, I think we all enjoyed so much just walking the streets and being able to see the beautiful architecture, even though it's a little run down because haven't had the coats of paint that could be put on it. But the Cuban people are so warm and friendly, and you're always invited in to have a cup of coffee. It's really quite a remarkable society.
Well, you know, it seems just like a lot of policy of Israel influences U.S. foreign policy through AIPAC. It also seems that there's a small group, very vocal group of right-wing Cubans, many of whom say they lost their family, lost their wealth during the overthrow of the Batista regime, that Cuba is run by a communist country and a communist government, and that the United States has no business other than strangling it, which of course they attempted to do in the cradle and were unsuccessful. How do you view U.S. foreign policy? It seems like it's held hostage to this small group of right-wing Cubans, mostly in Miami.
Well, I'd say you're exactly right on that. I mean, the political weight that group has in southern Florida, and people that get to know high-level politicians in our country, whether it's President Trump that lives down there, that's where his residence is, or whether it's people like Marco Rubio, a senator for a long time and now Secretary of State, they are deeply influenced by those that live in Little Havana, that live in southern Florida. But when you really get into the history of why, of the compensation for the nationalization of businesses and the taking of private homes, which that did happen, but there was compensation for it. And the United States is the only one of eight countries where the Cuban government has said, we want to compensate for the things that we, the government, took. All the other countries set up a claims commission, and they handled the claims. The Cuban government paid an amount of money, but the U.S. government didn't want to do that. They liked the turmoil, and this is not just one administration. This starting with John Kennedy's administration, so that's probably like 12 or 10 different administrations would rather overthrow the revolutionary government than to actually have compensated those American citizens and corporations whose goods were nationalized. And let me just do a little rant on dear Marco Rubio. Yeah, I was in the State Department for 16 years, and Marco is now the Secretary of State. Well, it turns out that Marco speaks out of both sides of his mouth on so many issues, but let's just get to two of them. You know, in the Supreme Court, yesterday was the argument about doing away with the birthright, that any person who's born in the United States becomes a citizen, even if their parents are non-naturalized or non-citizens of the United States, non-citizens. Well, guess who benefited from that? Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio's parents were not citizens of the United States when he was born in the United States. Marco Rubio's parents did not come to the United States because of the revolution. They immigrated to the United States 3 years before the revolution because of the conditions that Batista, the dictator, was putting on the country. And then one other thing on immigrants that live in our country, immigrants that may be here illegally. Well, guess what? Marco Rubio's grandfather was here as an illegal immigrant. Wow. He came one time as a legal immigrant and then went back and then came back again without getting a visa. So he was here illegally. He was stopped. He was arrested, detained, went before a judge. The judge said, sorry, you got to be deported because you're here illegally. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. and there were no flights that were going down to Cuba. So it ended up his grandfather got grandfathered in to a very benevolent project that the United States government sponsored, which said, you're a Cuban, you can't get back home, so we're giving you dispensation, so you're no longer deported. And so that's how the granddad got to stay here. And so here Marco Rubio, who's for deporting everybody that is here without legal status and putting them in detention facilities, horrible detention facilities and all that, not giving them a chance to go before a judge to argue their case for, you know, that they fled their country for violence or, you know, whatever. So old Marco Rubio has a lot to answer for in terms of his position where he is now, how he got there, and then what he's doing to other people.
Well, he often sounds so vicious and mean when he talks about Cuba and much of Latin America. I mean, we see that Bondi is gone, you know, Kristi Noem is gone, and now we can only hope that Rubio and Hegseth are in line there somewhere as maybe.
Well, let me just mention one other thing
sure,
about
of course.
Marco. You know, Cuban American, so you would think, well, he's been down to Cuba, he's seen, you know, what's going on there, and so he's formed an opinion. Well, guess how many times Marco Rubio has set foot on Cuban soil?
How many?
One time, and guess for how long?
How long?
Like 5 hours, and guess where he went? To the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo to look at the prison. So he doesn't know piddly squat about what goes on in the daily life of Cubans that live in Cuba.
Well, another one of those venerated government leaders that have been chosen under this current regime. Well, Anne, we're going to have to leave it there. Just amazing to talk to you today. Always a pleasure. You're always welcome on this show again. That's Colonel Anne Wright. She just returned from a Code Pink fact-finding delegation to the island of Cuba. Thank you so much for joining us today
here
on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 909 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine and Lebanon. Israel continues to shoot, attack, drone strike, and bomb Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, while maintaining a severe blockade on essential food, medicine, medical supplies, fuel, and materials for infrastructure repair. On Tuesday, March 31st, reporter Ibrahim Kanaan captured footage of a Palestinian child who was injured in a bombing that targeted a group of Palestinians in the Bayouk area of Khan Yunis. Kanaan stated that one man was killed along with his baby and others were injured. The local Wafa news agency reported that another Palestinian was killed and others were injured in a separate attack in Jabalia in northern Gaza, also on Tuesday, and two others were injured by Israeli gunfire east of the Bureij refugee camp in central Gaza. Israeli forces once again targeted Palestinian police checkpoints this week. Six Palestinians, including a young girl and three police officers, were killed in two separate Israeli strikes on police personnel on March 29th in the Mawasi area west of Khan Yunis. Over the past 3 weeks, Israel has routinely targeted Palestinian police officers in an effort to disrupt social order. Reporter Ibrahim Kanaan said that the attack occurred along with artillery shelling and gunfire along the eastern areas of Khan Yunis city in the southern Gaza Strip. Two brothers were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Shujaiya neighborhood of eastern Gaza City on March 28th, while they were directly confronting militias supported by Israel in defense of their home and their community. Journalist Ibrahim Bedouin accompanied a massive funeral march after Saad and Fahmi Kadoum were killed while foiling an incursion by the Israeli-aligned militias. The two brothers engaged the armed group in clashes, inflicting losses, before the Israeli occupation army sent a swarm of quadcopter drones and a warplane, which directly targeted them and killed them. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, more than 710 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,900 have been wounded since the so-called ceasefire began in October 2025. The Rafah crossing at the Gaza-Egypt border was partially reopened 2 weeks ago for a very limited number of Palestinians leaving for medical treatment and the return of those who sought treatment abroad during the last 2.5 years of Israel's genocide. This week, a group of small children who had been medically evacuated to Egypt in November 2023, most of them who were premature infants in incubators, were returned to their families after Israel cut the power to hospitals and then started bombing medical facilities. During the first few months of the genocide, 29 babies were transferred from the neonatal intensive care unit at Al-Shifa Hospital to other hospitals in Gaza before being evacuated. Four of the babies in critical condition of the group died. And notably, of course, Israel prevented the parents from accompanying their fragile newborns. These mothers and fathers had not seen their children since November 2023. Dr. Munir Al-Bursh, the director of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, recalled on social media the story of what the infants were put through. He stated, quote, "Few know the story of the premature infants while we were besieged inside Al-Shifa Medical Complex. When fuel was cut off, incubators fell silent, and the smallest lives began fading before our eyes, one after another. They were unbearable moments, babies struggling to breathe, without machines, without warmth, without enough life to hold on to. We called upon the world, save those who remain before it is too late. We carried them through hospital corridors, searching for any chance of survival. In scenes broadcast live and documented by international organizations, yet the world was too late. In the end, those who survived were transferred to Egypt for treatment, carrying the pain of their beginnings and the hope of survival. Today, life returns," he added. In a follow-up post, Dr. Al-Bursh said that doctors and healthcare workers, quote, "paid a steep price to never abandon them and stayed with them until the very last moment. And today they have returned alive to their mother's embraces to declare to the world that the will to live is stronger than the will to kill, and that Gaza, despite the pain, forges glory and inscribes victory by the grace of God." Meanwhile, the Palestinian Civil Defense and the Ministry of Health in Gaza stated this week that the electricity and fuel crisis due to Israel's ongoing blockade is threatening to shut down health and emergency services if a sufficient amount of fuel is not delivered immediately. On March 31st, the civil defense issued an urgent appeal to pressure the Israelis to allow in fuel for critical rescue and repair operations. Journalist Ibrahim Badouan showed the result of the deepening shortage of fuel and spare parts that is threatening hospital generators and is pushing the healthcare system toward collapse amid ongoing power outages. The civil defense stated that with the limited amount of fuel that they have received, which they estimate covers only about 15% of their monthly requirements, the humanitarian crisis is becoming exacerbated across Gaza. The rescue workers warned that the Israeli occupation authorities are deliberately employing a drip-feed policy regarding the entry of fuel into the Gaza Strip, a tactic that negatively impacts humanitarian intervention efforts and intensifies the suffering of the civilian population. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a 15-year-old child in the Dehesha refugee camp south of Bethlehem on March 27th. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Adam Syed Salah Beit Dahman, 15 years old, was shot in the pelvis by Israeli forces around 9 p.m. at the entrance to Dehesha. Four Israeli military vehicles arrived at the camp's entrance 30 minutes prior to the shooting, and young Palestinian men and boys threw stones toward the heavily armored vehicles in response. Soldiers disembarked from their armored vehicles and opened fire from about 200 meters away, striking Adam. After shooting Adam, Israeli forces surrounded him while beating him and shouting at him. Israeli soldiers prevented Palestine Red Crescent Society paramedics from reaching the child for about 30 minutes, Defense for Children International Palestine stated. Israeli forces eventually allowed one paramedic to reach Adam. An ambulance brought him to Beit Jela Governmental Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at 10:30 p.m. Adam's mother carried her son's body through the camp during his funeral on March 28th. Reporter Hisham Abu Shakra captured this clip. Israeli forces have killed 8 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2026, according to documentation collected by DCIP. Israeli forces and settlers killed 56 Palestinian children in the West Bank in 2025. Jewish Israeli settlers attacked a group of Palestinians on Tuesday in the town of Taisir in the northern West Bank, injuring at least 3. Eyewitnesses told the Anadolu news agency that the settlers attacked Palestinians on their land on the outskirts of the town, assaulting them with stones and sticks. The Israelis set fire to a tractor and other Palestinian property in the town, they added. After decades of Israel's de facto policy of killing Palestinians by torture, starvation, or denial of medical treatment inside prisons and detention camps, the Israeli parliament codified the policy into law this week, passing a measure that allows the execution of Palestinians by hanging, carried out by prison guards appointed by the Israeli prison service, with the identities of the executors kept secret and granted legal immunity. The law enjoys broad support from the Israeli public, notes human rights group B'Tselem. The Palestinian civil rights group Adala states that the law establishes, quote, clear racial separation, applying it exclusively to the Palestinian population of the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and excluding the Israeli Jewish population. Adala submitted a petition against the law just half an hour after the Israeli parliament passed it, according to the center's director, Hassan Jabarin. The law is racist, Jabarin told the Anadolu news agency. While many countries apply the death penalty, the statute is the only law in the world that discriminates between defendants based on ethnicity, he added. Israel's national security minister, extremist, settler, and war crimes suspect Itamar Ben-Gvir, a leading proponent of the measure who has been wearing a noose pin on his lapel in support, celebrated the passage of the law by opening up a bottle of champagne and toasting to the prospect of killing more Palestinians with his fellow lawmakers. More than 9,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 350 children and 73 women who are subjected to systematic torture, starvation, and medical neglect, practices that have escalated since the genocide began in October 2023. A general strike was announced across the occupied West Bank in protest of the execution law as Palestinians in Gaza protested in the streets. Reporter Mohammed Abu Salama captured video of crowds of demonstrators in Gaza holding signs against the law and burning photos of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. A spokesperson for the tribes and popular committees in Burej refugee camp in Gaza told the Anadolu news agency that the protest aimed, quote, to send a clear message to the occupation that the prisoners are not alone. Adopting such laws reflects confusion and failure, he said, stressing that tribal leaders declare that, quote, any harm to our prisoners will be met with an unexpected popular and national response. He emphasized that Palestinians stand united behind the prisoners' cause. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, at least 50 people were killed and nearly 200 were wounded between Tuesday and Wednesday alone, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. Since the Israeli attacks escalated on March 2nd, more than 1,300 Lebanese have been killed and nearly 4,000 have been wounded. In the south, Israel killed three journalists on March 28th while they were covering the Israeli invasion and attacks. Fatima Fatouni, a reporter for Al Mayadeen, was killed along with her brother, Mohammed, a video journalist, and Ali Shweb, a longtime correspondent with Al Manar TV. Their vehicle was clearly marked press, and Fatima Fatouni had just ended her live broadcast right before the airstrike killed her. In an attempt to supposedly justify the killing, Israeli forces claimed that Shweb was a member of Hezbollah's Radwan forces, a special operations arm of the military, echoing a tactic that Israel has used to justify the targeted murders of hundreds of Palestinian journalists in Gaza over the last 2.5 years of genocide. The military claimed that he worked to expose the locations of Israeli army troops operating in southern Lebanon in their invasion and occupation there, and that he engaged in incitement against Israeli troops, reports the publication Truthout. However, the only evidence the military offered was a photo of Shweb, a well-known war reporter who has covered the region for decades in supposed military garb. When a Fox News correspondent asked the Israeli military about the source of the photo, the military admitted that it was fake. Unfortunately, there isn't really a picture of it. It was photoshopped, the Israeli military said in a statement. In a post mourning their colleague Fatima Fatouni, Al-Mayadeen says that it was not the first time that one